Welcome to UBC Insiders On Air for the week of September 25th, 2015, the show that brings you incisive commentary, interviews, analysis, and the best-informed rumor mill around on UBC campus life and politics. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver. My name is Neil Janssen.
And I'm Mayan Kreitzman. You can always check out our website, ubcinsiders.ca, for written versions of some of what we talk about on air, and an awesome archive full of 8 years of breaking stories and busting balls all over the university.
For the weekly news roundup, we have Viet Vu joining us, who I would describe as one of the few voices of sanity currently on AMS Council.
After that, this episode is all UBC Board of Governors all the time. The current student reps on the board, Veronica Knott and Julie Van de Valk, both turned us down for interviews, which is kind of disappointing. But let's be real, we're probably going to have a better conversation with our illustrious and colorful panel of former Board of Governors reps anyways. Tim Lumen-Gardner, Azam Wazir, and Darren Peets will all be joining us for the Great Bog Panel of 2015. Joining us this week to discuss the news of the day is Viet Vu. He's a fifth-year student in economics, the former president of the Vancouver School of Economics Undergraduate Society, and he still sits as the economics constituency representative on AMS Council. He writes a regular column for the UBC before each council meeting, giving a preview of the agenda.
Viet is also an active advocate for LGBTQ issues, and just so that we're not listing things about him for 5 minutes, I'll mention something totally random that he definitely had no involvement in. During last year's AMS elections, a candidate ran for AMS president wearing a Guy Fawkes mask, who is only known as V. The identity of the person behind the mask remains an everlasting mystery, but for whatever reason, that sprang to mind now that Viet's in the studio with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So this week in News Briefs, let's start off with UBC's new VP External. Who's been appointed, Neil?
It's Philip Steenkamp, who basically is in that role right now at SFU.
Okay, and he's, when I was reading up on his bio, he seems like a sort of gadfly of public administration jobs all over the place.
Well, he seems to be going back and forth between the government and the people that need the government to be nice to them.
So is that sort of revolving door like a good thing, or?
So it's really recent news, and obviously with a lot of the sort of a leadership change that has been happening across UBC these days, it's honestly kind of nice. One of the big sort of issue that has come up is how UBC has been appearing in the news recently. So it's a really positive sign that we have this person who has a lot of experience who's been dealing with external communication stuff to sort of support UBC's image, if you are outside.
I mean, is it helpful to UBC's image that he's another white dude?
At least at the first glance, it's not. But at the same time, I am a firm believer in the sense that if the person is right for the job, then they should take it. But with that said, it is still a fact that there are many capable people, race, sex, sexual orientation, all of those things, even though it should play a role, shouldn't play too big of a role as long as that person's capable.
Moving on, the AMS has finally decided to pull the trigger on a long overdue governance review.
So I feel like they do this every so often, but then I was reading about it and it seems like it hadn't been done for a couple of decades. But in my memory of AMS Council, there's always some sort of strategic planning or governance review, like big picture thing that the president instigates.
The last time an actual governance review has actually happened in the AMS was back in 93-94. And back then it was called COLP. And a lot of recommendation came out of that governance review that ended up creating the structure we have today in terms of standing committees, in terms of the executive structure and everything. Organization of AMS size usually has a governance review every 5 to 6 years or so.
Previous ones that you're mentioning, Leanne, have been focused on certain areas. So revamping the committee structure, that definitely happened. And the governance of the committees there is examined and probably changed, but it doesn't change the overall structure of the organization. I think this one's meant to get at all the issues from top to bottom.
Okay, so moving on. We all know that the transit referendum in the spring failed. But now the voter turnout stats are out for that transit referendum, and electoral area A, i.e. UBC, only had 36% of 18 to 24-year-olds voting compared to 44% of that same age group voting in the city of Vancouver and 41% overall. So that's a little disappointing if we needed to be depressed about something else other than the failure of the whole thing. And this is despite copious amounts of money that was spent on Get Out the Vote campaigns by both UBC and the AMS.
So I actually do have a few thoughts on that. The main sort of theme is that UBC is a commuter campus. It can only really house so many students when we're a university of 50,000 students. And so only a fraction of UB students actually live in Electoral Area A, where a lot of students, I would say the vast majority of students, commute to campus every day. And as an effect, those are the students who actually use transit every day, who knows the plight of having the 99 pass them by, having to rush through the SkyTrain station to get to the seat of 99, and who would care much more about the transit issue than a lot of students who just wake up from their bed in Marine Drive, kind of cooks breakfast really slowly, and just walks really casually to class.
So your theory is that the AMS Get Out the Vote campaign would actually push up turnout in the suburbs while not doing anything at UBC?
A lot of the stuff that happened in the Get Out the Vote campaign with the VP External's office was, for example, coffee with commuters. So every day, the VP External office would bring out free coffee at the bus loop, and those are obviously directly targeted at people who don't live at UBC.
So moving on to this round of Board of Governors meetings, they met for the committee meetings this week, and next week at UBC Okanagan will be the general board meeting. One of the things on the agenda is the strategic plan for varsity athletics. What's your take on that, Viet?
It's no secret that varsity athletic or athletic in general in UBC has been going through interesting times, especially with President Toop's athletic review, with a lot of teams losing varsity start and going to competitive status. And I do feel like a lot of them feel lost on the direction UBC is going on. A strategic direction, sort of a dream picture of where they want to go, is definitely needed to boost morale.
People inside the program just need to have an idea of what's happening. They can't be living with uncertainty of whether they're going to have a team in 2 years, because that affects everything, and especially recruitment. You can't recruit athletes if your team is going to fold in 2 years and there's going to be nowhere for them to play. Because for you, you clearly didn't come for athletics, and most of the regular student body wouldn't, but the athletes do specifically come to UBC for the programs that we have in, you know, swimming or football or baseball or what have you.
When everybody's confused as to what is happening, people start sort of gossiping, people start sort of not working together as well, and people sort of lose sight of what they're really for. So I would definitely agree.
So the last two things from board that I'll just mention, a policy number 118 was passed governing the use of security cameras on campus. It's my understanding that you will probably see security cameras at the bus loop soon. And then the other interesting thing is that a tall wood building, a 53-meter high student residence made out of wood, mostly with a concrete core, was given the go-ahead to put shovels in the ground and get building.
Yeah, the photos of that are pretty cool. And while we're on the board meeting topic, this is the first scheduled board meeting of the year, but what's the count on the number of secret board meetings so far?
We don't know. John Montalbano was not at the committee meeting, I'll note. He might have called in.
Okay, well, we'll keep that tally in the background, and maybe we'll count up at the end of the year, based on rumors, of course. That's it for news briefs.
Having trouble finding affordable, fresh baked goods and coffee? Come down to Agora Cafe, located in the McMillan Building at UBC. There's also space available to study.
I'm Neil Janssen, in studio with my co-host Mayan Kreitzman, and you're listening to UBC Insiders On Air. Right here in the studio with us, we have Azam Wazir and Tim Lumen-Gardner. Azam was a BOG rep in 2010-2011 and has since worked in real estate research and development. Tim was a BOG rep in 2005-06 and is currently working as a lawyer in Vancouver with Ferris. He was also the co-founder of UBC Insiders together with Gina Ahm in 2007, making him a magnanimous sort of fatherly figure to subsequent generations of the blog.
And Skyping in from Japan, we also have Darren Peets, who was on board in 2007-2008. Before that, Darren was the handler of the legendary fire hydrant, a venerable AMS Joe candidate with the Radical Beer faction.
Just so that listeners are all on the same page, we will tear through a brief backgrounder so that we can skip the technocratic questions and jump straight to the interesting stuff. First of all, the board has 21 members, consisting of the chancellor, the president, three faculty members, three students, two staff, and 11 provincial appointees, two of whom must be nominated by the Alumni Association.
According to the University Act, the management, administration, and control of the property, revenue, business, and affairs of the university are vested in the board.
The board chair is elected by the board itself, and only provincial appointees are eligible to hold this post.
Students, faculty, and staff are elected to sit on the board, but they owe a fiduciary duty to the university. In the words of the University Act, the members of the board of a university must act in the best interest of the university. As such, the elected members aren't traditional democratically elected representatives because they're responsible to a different group of people than the ones who elected them.
Also under the University Act, the board has essentially complete autonomy over their internal processes and governance. The only official recorded policies they've generated about this are Policy 93, which state the reasons why the board can have closed meetings, and a code of conduct for their members. Many other things they do are done by convention, but are not written down anywhere.
Also, in theory, the board and the Senate have equal authority, but over separate parts of the university. The board for finances and land management, and the Senate for academic governance.
So with that out of the way, let's talk to our guests. One of my longstanding complaints is that the board usually gets its information solely from the submissions that are generated for it and doesn't necessarily really hear from other sources. And even stakeholder comments, when they're received, are often filtered through whatever source is delivering the information. And so would you say that board members know enough to do their job well, Azam?
The way I see it is that there is a lot of information flowing towards the individual board members. It is the staff's responsibility to ensure that the governors are being given the best possible information, sort of a between a rock and a hard place situation where the alternative would be too much chaos, I believe, if we were to just open the floodgates, per se, to anyone to submit information. There has to be some sort of filter. Now, does that mean that some voices will feel marginalized or left out? I think that's sort of an inevitable conclusion. I don't think that that is the intention or the motivation of the Secretariat when they are putting together information.
But it does happen. I have spotted submissions that have gone to board with flat-out factual inaccuracies.
I mean, the board's job is not to be involved in sort of the operational, on-the-ground information gathering. That's not their job, nor should it be, nor can it be. Mm-hmm. So there has to be some level of filtration. There has to be a funneling. The question is whether or not that is effective. And unfortunately, you only sort of have a case-by-case way to identify that.
Darren, go ahead.
Basically, the board has taken on the role of a municipal government, and it's really not an appropriate body for that.
But a municipal government would hear from their stakeholders regularly. Elsewhere, hearing multiple views would strengthen opinions and make sure that they can hold up to scrutiny. But when the board hears things, it's not really held up to scrutiny to make sure that it can survive legitimate or reasonable criticism.
Well, a lot of the board decisions still involve other layers of stakeholder engagement. So the classic example would be development. You still have various development approval steps in the process.
Like how? It all gets filtered through a submission from campus and community planning.
Yeah, the whole point is that if I'm engaging in that process, I tell campus community planning what I think, and then campus community planning tells the board what they think I think.
So I think Darren makes an excellent point, and it's a particularly unique situation that UBC is currently in where there is a municipal governance aspect under its purview, which was not necessarily what it was designed for. We're not theoretically representing constituents, and therefore we're not supposed to be, we don't operate necessarily with an open door policy for these non-constituents of ours to come in and lobby us on things.
Right. Tim?
Of course, UBC's board does have people that are representing constituents to a degree, which is again sort of this distinction between UBC's board and a typical corporate board.
Correct.
One of the fun things that every student board rep gets their first day on the job is a little lecture from University Council, who will sit them down and say, you are not accountable to the people you voted for. Your job is to vote in the best interest of the university. That's completely accurate. The difficulty is, I think a lot of student bog reps hear the word fiduciary and panic a little. They think to themselves, whatever the university tells me is in the best interest of the university is in the best interest of the university. That's not necessarily the case. There's a wide latitude open to student board reps to say, what I think is in the interest of students is in the interest of the university. And I would like student bog reps to remember that and avail themselves of that wide latitude at every possible opportunity.
I just wanted to pick up again before we leave the issue of staff and how board members are prepared to bring up a specific character, Rennie, who's the board secretary.
Who wants to be the first one to tell us about Rennie?
Well, I can't because when I was on the board, 2005-2006, Rennie was not the board secretary. She was the executive assistant to the president of the university at the time, who was, of course, Martha Piper.
Rennie started as the board secretary around the same time I started on board. And I considered her a pretty major upgrade on her predecessor. Her predecessor had been in that role since before there were students on the board, as I recall, and seems to view students as interlopers to some degree. Rennie was a lot more open to the student board reps. So she encountered students in two roles, one as board reps, who seems to be relatively competent most of the time, and two, as groups of people who wanted to come in and disrupt the board. And she was really cautious and really suspicious of groups of students. For the board reps, she was quite good, but she was sort of fearful of making the board too open and too accessible.
So we were having an informal discussion with another former board rep. I mean, he was commenting on the amount of power that she sort of has, and it seemed like the title of board secretary doesn't really capture the amount of power that she seems to possess.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that her role being the primary gatekeeper to the board comes with, if you want to call it power, then sure. I think that she does an excellent job at ensuring that her governors are informed and in some ways assisted and protected.
Why do governors need to be protected?
A little over half the board is made up of people who are unfamiliar with the peculiarities of the post-secondary world. And there is the potential for those board members to find themselves in difficult situations where they don't necessarily understand how a university works or what is appropriate in a university setting.
So it sounds like you're saying they need protection from themselves.
Perhaps, yes.
She likes to ensure the smooth functioning of the board and the board meetings, but there's a lot of cases where I don't feel that it should necessarily be smooth.
On that point, Darren, I've always thought that the board does deserve a bit of protection, but at the same time, every once in a while they need to get down in it. I'm a big fan of making every board member once a year just go to a famous council meeting and take some heat, or go into a classroom or something like that, just to get a sense of what sort of the boots on the ground are like. Mm-hmm. They can't be expected to know what's going on the ground at all times, but I think they should be expected to at least have had a taste of what it's like.
Yeah.
Right, so that's one quick question I might have, which is, earlier this year I tried to find contact information for any of the board members, and no contact information for any board member is publicly available. So is it right that they shouldn't be subject to any access from the public?
So it's always sent through Rennie. To some degree, I think that's done to make things fair and even and put all of the people contacting them on an equal footing. I'm not convinced that it's right, but this is where we come back to the issue that they're essentially doing municipal governance, and they're not an appropriate body to do that.
So let's get back to what you were saying, Tim, about board members really needing to get into it. The board seems to operate on a consensus model where there aren't any close votes. Everyone is saying yes, except for some very rare instances, usually around tuition. When you work on that model, how are dissenting views aired, first of all, and ultimately resolved?
Well, you're quite right to point out that it operates on consensus, but it's not a bottom-up consensus, it's a top-down consensus. So the consensus has been reached before it gets to the board. So dissenting views at the board level are a formality. They're there because usually a student rep, occasionally a staff or faculty rep, thinks that it's important that the board members hear a point. Dissent is just aggregated into the filter well before it gets to board.
I've heard that a lot of interesting conversations happen at lunch. Does anyone want to comment on that? Sounds like Darren does.
They will normally pick one or two issues where they actually want to discuss it in some detail where they don't really know what to do or where they should go or how much of a priority they should put on things. And they'll have some sort of a frank discussion while everyone eats.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's a fair characterization of what's going on at lunch. I would just add...
So, why does that happen at lunch?
Lunch is called reflections, and that's essentially what it comes down to now, is just a sort of free exchange of ideas in an open environment.
One of the ones that came up for us is, so we were given a surprise 2.6% budget cut, thanks to the provincial government. And they spent about an hour on it in open, and then the discussion over lunch was the stuff that they couldn't say in the open, about the actual people and contact that they'd had and contact they'd tried to have, where the situation came from in the first place, that sort of thing, where if the information got out, it could actually be kind of damaging for the university since that's where their money comes from.
But overall, it sounds like the actual business of governing happens at lunch, whereas the rubber stamping happens in the open meeting.
No, I don't think that's a fair characterization. No, what Asim said was what happens is the exchange of ideas that is reflected in governing later on down the line.
I was wondering if this issue with top-down consensus stems from the fact that most of the board members are provincial appointees. Most of them don't have a background in higher education. They're appointed through some sort of patronage. Maybe they bring real skills to the board. I don't know.
Both can be true.
Okay. And, you know, there's a minority of board members that are elected from the university environment. And I was wondering, what are the differences in the attitude that those two categories of board members bring to the table?
The appointees tend to be from business, so they tend to bring a very business board sensibility to it.
And why are they always money types? Like, why is that a thing?
Because they're aiming for successful people who have been successful in their fields. And as a general rule, when you get successful in a field for long enough, you're going to get paid by somebody somewhere somehow.
They do tend to view it as a corporate board, and with a liberal government in there, they have strong opinions on what that means, although the university itself at the moment has similar opinions. They are managing something very large with a lot of money passing through. When I was there, the rubric didn't include experience with nonprofits, and the other thing that you could imagine wanting represented in there is people watching out for the public good, because the university is supposed to play a role in society, and that sort of thing didn't really seem to be a concern.
Yeah, I was going to say, Tim, like the idea that if you get really good at something, someone's going to pay you, I kind of take issue with that. I mean, I think there are potentially excellent governors out there that work in community development or teachers. They could probably do a better job than bank CEOs and whatnot, you know, that come from a really narrow frame of reference and know nothing about higher education.
Absolutely.
So maybe we can talk about how it is to be a student on the board. You get these big dockets, they're hundreds of pages long, you have to sit down and prepare with them, and you are sort of the token voice of dissent quite often. How would you approach articulating your dissent?
In order to effectively articulate dissent, you need to bring a perspective to the problem that demonstrably hasn't been shown yet. So what you need to be doing is saying, there is a problem with what's in this package. The reason this problem exists is because nobody's looked at it in this particular way. That also doubles as being a constructive way to solve a problem. That's what board people tend to respond to.
And Darren, you were quite good at that. How would you say the most effective way is to register student dissent?
He had 6 years of practice.
Yeah, so the student perspective very often doesn't make it in there before it hits the board. And on a number of these issues, the students do actually have opinions. And that's something that, like Tim said, hasn't been included. And if you bring that up, in some cases, you can get some traction. But it's better if you can get to this before it gets to the board. You have to know what's coming, and you have to be talking with the staff.
The other way to do it, which is one that Darren was particularly good at, was just being the smartest person in the room on something. Either way, you become an authority, and it may be a narrow authority, but you become the person that they listen to.
I think something that's worth bearing and remembering here is also that as a governor, you are not influencing policy outcomes or the strategic direction of the university. What you're trying to do is you're trying to provide oversight to an administrative team that you hire to execute that, right? So if you feel like you're dissenting on something, if the approach that you're going to take is you want to change the administration's stated goals, that's going to be kind of challenging. And so generally you're trying to shape what they're pursuing in a way that is either more beneficial to students or less of a harm.
One of the main criticisms of the student members is that they're only there to sort of network and advance their careers. They get to hobnob with fancy people. And even if that's not what they intend to do when they're going in, they get co-opted and subdued rather easily. And I was just looking at the board members from this year, the student board members. There's a really stark contrast in the tone between their feisty, like, campaigns and how mousy they are right now. And they didn't say anything throughout the whole Gupta affair to the media at all. So that criticism does kind of resonate with me. And I was wondering what your take on that is. Tim?
In the specific context of the mass outbreak of silence, I have some sympathy for the student representatives on the board because, number one, they're suddenly on the board of a couple billion dollar institution and they're told what we do is be silent and it's your job as a fiduciary of the Salve University to be silent and not mess things up. And it takes a large pair to say, no, I disagree with you. I hope they're raising heck behind the scenes. They may be, they may not be, I don't know.
The other thing is they even were told that they're not allowed to reveal the existence of unscheduled meetings. What Veronica told me when I asked her why she didn't tell students about all the unscheduled meetings that took place was that some lawyer had told her that she's not allowed to.
Well, I can't speak to Veronica's experience, but there were instances where I had discussions offline with members of the executive team and staff, and it was perfectly fine, I think, to say that I had a discussion with them, and I don't think they would have been upset with me if I had had to have made that statement. Perhaps the contents of it would have to have been confident.
Well, let's ask the lawyer in the room, Tim. Is there any legal basis for this idea that they shouldn't reveal the existence of in-camera meetings even if they don't talk about the content of them?
I'm not going to give you a legal answer because I don't know it, but I am going to say I've racked my brain for the basis on which the Board of Governors of a public university could have a secret meeting, and I've not found one. I can see the idea of having a meeting, going immediately in camera, and then going out of camera and adjourning the meeting. But the idea that a meeting is held and that the existence of the meeting is secret, that's a big governance red flag in my view. So again, this is why, again, I have sympathy for the student rep who's in that position, who suddenly a lawyer comes in and tells us, what are you going to do? Say, no, you're wrong? What do you know?
And we'll keep asking them for interviews until hopefully they say yes.
As well you should.
Essentially, and this is what I said in the intro, like, why is the board such an asshole organization? Why?
In my day, it wasn't. In my day, the board was a deferential organization, but it was a rubber stamp organization to a degree, but it wasn't an asshole organization in my day.
Okay, so what has changed? What has gone downhill? Well,
it would seem to me that that people's perceptions of the board right now, things like, why is it an asshole board, I think has a lot to do with the experience that UBC has just undergone with Arvind Gupta's resignation.
Sure, but that's only a rather blatant example of how they run themselves.
What's the less blatant example, then?
Well, they tried to ban all photography and recording at their meetings earlier this year.
For the periods of time that I watched the boards most intensely, people thought that the board was perhaps elusive, but I didn't think it was particularly combative in that way that would deserve the title asshole. I think that is more a reflection of current events than perhaps long-term reality.
The other thing I would say has increased lately is things that do not appear on the committee agenda and then seem to appear out of nowhere on the board agenda.
I guess that's better left to the people who are actually on the board.
And so it's, you know, things that are, those types of things are fairly subtle that most people aren't going to notice, but raise huge red flags when they happen. Darren?
So this is another place where I may be inadvertently partially responsible, because I was talking with the legal team while I was on board about them not having any sort of a guideline at all for what would be an open and what would be enclosed. But they developed this after I left the board and brought it in for approval with the next crop of students. It may have, for instance, allowed them to put things into closed that were merely uncomfortable. And part of my plan was we would have we would have good people on there who would question this and say, well, but you're basically doing government. You can't do that.
The policy that they came up with leaves the open or closed decision completely in the hands of the chair.
But presumably that can be overridden by the board itself?
No.
Well, then you would just vote to move it out of closed in the board, and that would work.
Technically,
yeah. I suppose, yeah.
The last thing is, I guess, Darren mentioned that this Board of Governors doesn't function very well as a municipal government, which is kind of what it's called upon to do. How would you envision a better governance structure that would be more democratic, more open, less top-down, etc.? Darren?
Council of Stakeholders.
I think that's an extremely broad topic. Within the constraints of the existing system, I think what the Board of Governors needs to do is just make a bit more of an effort to get a sense of what it's like on the ground. There is probably a massive governance overhaul that's required in this municipal context. I think we could spend another 6 hours debating over what that could be. But I think the short-term solution is just try not to lose touch with why they're doing what they're doing.
The issue is they've never been in touch with why they're doing what they're doing.
On what do you base that?
Well, on the fact that they're provincial appointees that don't know much about the workings of universities or this university, and they come in to represent things. Darren?
A lot of them don't know what a university is. They have no experience with universities. They don't have experience with municipal government, and they're not ready for this. They've got a responsibility for municipal stuff that really needs to be offloaded to someone else.
If you take away the municipal government's perspective, I think overall, at least in my experience with the board, it did a pretty reasonably fine job.
Okay, well, I think we'll wrap it up there. We want to give a big thank you to Tim, to Azim, and to Darren for joining us. It was pretty cool to have you all in the same virtual room after all these years.
Well, thank you for having us. And as the magnanimous father figure, thank you for setting up a wonderful podcast. It sounds great to listen.
Well, that's our show. I'm Mayan Kreitzman, and you've been listening to UBC Insiders On Air, broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and podcasted at CITR.ca. You can follow us on Twitter at UBC Insiders, check out the blog UBCinsiders.ca, or email us. We're both easy to find on Google. Thanks, Neil.
Thank you, and we'll talk to you next week. We'll be talking to Hannah Whitman, the academic director of the UBC Farm, about the big donation they scored and highlights from the Harvest Feast.
Sounds tasty. Can't wait. Insiders out.